Professor Hubie, it's a great honor and privilege for me to accept this award as an honorary member of this marvelous society. I must say, it gives me tremendous pleasure over the last few years to be so comfortable in Austria as I am today. To think that in 1939, I left because I wouldn't have survived had I stayed, and to think that I'm coming here being treated as a peer is really wonderful for me. I'm also very pleased that Rudolf Hunziger had invited me to come to Vienna to give this talk, and I'm very pleased that Chancellor Bronetsky is sitting in, as well as my friend Erwin Rosinger, who may have heard aspects of this talk before. So, ladies and gentlemen, the central challenge of science in the 21st century is to understand the human mind in biological terms. The possibility of opening that challenge began in the late 20th century when cognitive psychology, the science of the mind, merged with neuroscience, the science of the brain. The result was a new biological science of mind that allowed us to address a range of questions about ourselves. How do we perceive, learn, remember? What is the nature of emotion, empathy, and consciousness? The new biological science of mind is important not only because it provides a deeper understanding of what makes us who we are, but also because it makes possible a meaningful series of dialogues between brain science and other areas of knowledge. In a larger sense, these dialogues could help make science part of our common cultural experience. I would like to take up this challenge this evening by focusing on how the new biological science of mind has begun to address figurative arts. In my life as a scientist, I've often benefited from taking a reductionist approach. I try to explore a large problem that interests me. In my case, that has been a problem of memory storage, by initially focusing on the simplest example and trying to explore it deeply. I will also do so tonight. I will limit my discussion to one particular art form, portraiture, in one particular period, modernism in Vienna 1900. You've heard of Vienna 1900, I hope. Good. I focus on portraiture because it's a highly suitable art form for scientific exploration. We now have the beginnings of an intellectually satisfying understanding of how we respond to facial expressions and bodily postures of others. Man ruft mich? Nein. I focus on portraiture in the period Vienna 1900 because this artistic school of painters can be explored in depth. There are only three major artists, Klimt, Kokoschka, and Schiele, yet the school is important in the history of art, both collectively and individually. As a group, they sought to depict the unconscious instinctual striving of the people in their portraits, yet each artist developed a distinctive way of using facial expressions and hand and body gestures to communicate their insights. In so doing, each artist made independent conceptual and technical contributions to modern art. Moreover, the concern of these artists with the truth lying beneath the surface of appearance of their subjects was paralleled by and influenced by similar concerns with unconscious mental processes in contemporaneous scientific medicine and psychoanalysis. Thus, the portraiture of the modernists of Vienna 1900 also represents an ideal example of how artistic, psychological, and scientific insights can influence one another. In fact, I think one of the extraordinary things of Vienna 1900 was the way that different sciences interacted so successfully in trying to understand modern life. Let me begin with the origins of modern thought. Modern thought began in the mid-19th century, in part as a response to the restrictions and hypocrisies of everyday life, but even more as a reaction to the Enlightenment of the 18th century and its excessive emphasis on the rationality of human behavior. The Enlightenment, or Age of Reason, was characterized by the belief that humans were specifically created by God as rational creatures that differed from other living creatures by having their actions guided by reason. These Enlightenment beliefs were inspired by the extraordinary success of the scientific revolution of the 16th and 17th century. it was argued that the success of this revolution derived from the application of reasoned thinking to the study of the universe by great rational minds such as those of Copernicus, Kepler, Galileo, and Newton. The remarkable achievements of the scientific revolution were celebrated in 1660 with the formation of the Royal Society of London, of which Newton became president in 1703. The founders of the society thought of God as a mathematician who designed the universe to operate according to logical and mathematical principles. This is not the Jewish definition of God, in case you're not aware. The function of the scientists was to decipher the code book God had used to create the universe. This perspective led to the belief we would live in a rational world in which reasoned and enlightened thought would ultimately lead to a better condition for all humankind. In reacting to the Enlightenment, modernism represented a search for a new worldview, a view partially provided by Charles Darwin. Darwin argued humans are not uniquely created, but biological creatures that have evolved from simple animal ancestors. That evolution is driven by sexual selection, so that from an evolutionary perspective, the primary function of a biological organism is to reproduce itself. Since sexual attraction and mate selection are central to the behavior of all animals, sex must be central to human behavior. And he didn't even live in Vienna and he knew all of this. A key to sexual attraction, mate selection, and indeed to all social interactions is facial expressions and the emotion it mediates. Remember, this is more than 50 years before Freud. Modernism has many roots. The Viennese form of modernism, the Age of Insight, has three main features, and it characterizes the world we live in today. Modern thought originated right here. A new view of the human mind is not being rational, but driven by unconscious sexual and aggressive drives. The conviction that the search for the rules that govern the nature of the human mind begins with an examination of oneself. A broad attempt to integrate and unify knowledge, an attempt driven by science. And one example of this attempt at integration was the initiation of an art dialogue between art and science. This dialogue that originated in modernist thought, Vienna 1900, had three phases, each of which I will consider with you. The independent discovery in Vienna of different aspects of unconscious mental processes by two physicians, Freud and Schnitzler. I'm only going to speak about Freud. And three modernist artists, Klimt, Kokoschka, Schiele, all of whom I will argue were greatly influenced by common source, Karl von Rokitansky, head of the Vienna School of Medicine, and my hero. His grandson is sitting somewhere in the audience. Would you raise your right here? The first attempt to bridge art to science, the science with psychology, by three Viennese art historians, Riegel, Chris, and Gombrich, through a focus on the beholder's share. And finally, a further bridging of art to science through a biological analysis of the beholder's share, analysis that is just beginning, continues to this day. The first steps of this were also taken in Vienna by Stephen Kufler, a visual physiologist who originally was trained at the Vienna School of Medicine and again had to leave in 1938. So let me begin with the first phase, medical art. It is hard to believe that until the beginning of the 18th century, medicine in Europe and therefore throughout the world was amazingly primitive. It began to move in a more empirical direction with the French Revolution. In the 1800s, there was a change in the structure of the universities, change in the structure of the hospitals, so they began to interact a little bit more with one another, and that led to some scientific progress. But with the July monarchy and increase in sort of conservatism at the university, that energy dissipated and the attention shifted to Vienna, which now became the focus. And with time, young people, rather than going to Paris, started to come to Vienna. It actually started somewhat earlier. Maria Theresia had the insight to realize you can have a great army without taking good physical care of the people in the army. So she recruited the great Dutch physician, Gerard from Swieten, to come to Vienna to become her personal physician, but also the physician for the army. He realized that one also needed to take care of the populace. And his successor, Andreas von Stift, pushed to develop a new hospital. And with Joseph II, who followed Maria Theresia, the Vienna General Hospital, the Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus, was established. As all of you know, the Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus differed from all hospitals in the world in several regards. One is it belonged to the University of Vienna Medical School, and the University Medical School belonged to the University of Vienna. So it had the high standards of a university that applied to the medical school and to the hospital. This did not exist anyplace in Europe. Number two, every single person who died in Allgemeine Wiener Krankenhaus was autopsied. This was unheard of throughout Europe. And finally, every single person who was autopsied by one person, the head of pathology. In 1844, this became Karl von Mokotansky. Karl von Mokotansky performed 60,000 autopsies. Now, before you have a nervous breakdown, let me assure you, he didn't do them all with his own little hands. He had help from other people. But he was the intellectual driving force. I should also point out to you that he not only was a great pathologist, a great lead of the scientific community, he became dean of the medical school, he became a spokesman for the scientific community, was elected to parliament, and his insights really permeated intellectual life. Rokotansky said, you know, how are we going to treat sick people? We don't understand sickness. We don't know how to make an accurate diagnosis. They had stethoscopes. They could tap on the chest. They didn't know what those sounds meant. Sometimes they heard an unusual sound from the region of the heart. They didn't know how to interpret it. So Rokotansky said, we have to find ways of making better diagnoses. And what you do is you take an accurate history from the patient. You take a very careful physical. And he asked his colleague, an outstanding clinician, Josef Skoda, to do that. Listen very carefully to the heart, to the lungs, and if that patient dies, you and I together will do the autopsy and we'll see what accounted for the illness. So if, for example, they find a peculiar sound coming from the heart and the patient dies, they will examine the heart and they may see a stenosis of the mitral valve. And to make sure that this is responsible for the sound they heard, they would flow water through the mitral valve and see whether they simulated the sound. This is pretty remarkable for its day. So as a result of this, they were able to place medicine on a scientific basis, the first scientific basis, by developing a clinical pathological correlation. To this day, this is the fundamental platform in which medicine is practiced. So let me outline for you very briefly the contributions that Rokotansky made. He provided the modern scientific medicine through systematic clinical pathological correlations. He emphasized the principle that the truth is often hidden below the surface. You have to go deep in order to understand it. This is in intellectual endeavors as well as in scientific endeavors. He trained future leaders of academic medicine. One of them was Sigmund Freud. And he recruited world-leading scientists, including Theodor Billdorf, for whom this building is named, who very soon emerged as the most important surgeon in the world. He radically revolutionized surgery. He was the first one to open up the abdomen. He was the one to remove stomach cancers. He was bold and farsighted in his surgical insights. Let me focus on one of these contributions, the fact that he trained future leaders of medicine. Many of you may not be aware, but Sigmund Freud was an extraordinary biologist. We did not hear, when you saw the picture, Principles of Neuroscience, the new edition of which just came out 1 year, that the picture on the cover is a picture of a ganglion that Freud had analyzed. Freud studied the nervous system of simple vertebrate animals, fish, and also the nervous system of invertebrate animals. Since I studied invertebrate animals, I particularly like Freud. And he realized that the nerve cells of very simple animals are the same as the nerve cells in your brain and mine. So Darwin's insight into the conservation of evolution applies to the brain as well as it does to every other organ. Freud made some wonderful discoveries. He had insights into cerebral palsy, into aphasia, and he wanted to be a basic scientist. But in those days, you had to have a private income to be practicing in basic science. He didn't have that. He wanted to get married to Martha Benes. So he gave up basic science and went into clinical practice. I should tell you that while he was in basic science, every seminar he gave, Rokitansky went to. Rokitansky had a rule that if you presented a paper at the University of Vienna Medical School, he heard it, and he had to approve of it at the end. And Rokitansky approved his performance, was very pleased with the way Freud was doing, and when Rokitansky died, Freud went to his funeral and wrote to friends what an enormous loss this is for world medicine. And when Freud died, people wrote, isn't it fortunate that Freud trained with Rokitansky, because psychoanalysis is such a speculative discipline. Imagine where it would have gone if Freud had not trained with Rokitansky. So, at first Freud thought he would become a neurologist, but there were a lot of neurologists in Vienna. So he was really moving towards psychiatry, and the person that pushed him there is a friend of his, a senior colleague by the name of Breuer. Breuer had encountered a very interesting patient that fascinated Freud. The patient's name is in disguise form called Anna O. Anna O presented to Breuer with a hysterical paralysis of her right arm. Why did he think it was hysterical paralysis? He examined her very carefully. There was absolutely nothing wrong with her neurologically. And as he began to talk to her, he also hypnotized her because he'd been influenced by Charcot, who pointed out you can treat hysteria with hypnosis. But he realized that he didn't just learn from her hypnotic trances, he also learned by talking to her and listening to her. So free association, transference between a therapist and a patient began not with Freud, but with Breuer. This is something Freud took from him. And as he listened to and talked to her, he realized what happened to her in the later months of her father's life. Her father used to like to sleep with his head resting on her shoulder, the shoulder that ended up being paralyzed. And while he was in his position, he had positive thoughts and negative thoughts. And when he died in his position, and she felt very guilty about the negative thoughts, and this ended up in a paralysis. And as she talked about it and explored it more and more with Breuer, the paralysis relieved itself and she was fine. Freud said, this is marvelous. This is what I want to do. He took the next boat to France, couldn't fly in those days, and studied with Charcot, came back, set up a practice in psychoanalysis, and decided he wouldn't use hypnosis. He only used transference, interaction with the patient, free association. And he tried something remarkable. In 1895, he tried to put his knowledge of biology together with his beginning understanding of psychoanalysis to develop a biological model of psychoanalysis. And he wrote a paper called Psychoanalysis for the Neurologists. Have any of you in the audience by any chance read it? Raise your hand if you have. Excellent. The rest of you don't try. It's incomprehensible. I spent several months trying to understand it completely, and if you ever buy my book, and I don't urge this on you, there's a diagram. It took me several months to decipher based upon his book. Anyway, he realized this is hopeless. We know so little about the brain to try to understand unconscious and conscious process. It's absurd. So he gave it up, and he developed a cognitive psychology, an abstract model of the mind. He took observable behavior based on the patient's symptoms and normal behavior. He developed a theoretical understanding, a dynamic scientific psychology based upon his understanding of both conscious and unconscious mental processes, which he evolved based on the clinical material. And he said, someday, in several generations, brain science will go to the point where they will falsify many of my ideas. He was actually quite modest in the way he viewed biology. He realized that though he tried to be as rigorous as possible, some of this work was really quite speculative, and science would come along, show some things were right, some things were wrong. What are Freud's scientific contributions? Three key ideas. That human beings were not rational creatures, they're driven by irrational and unconscious mental processes. Adult character, including unconscious sexuality and aggression, can be traced to the mind of a child. This is quite profound. No one had this thought before. And even more profound, he said, no mental event occurs by chance. There's no noise in the machine. Mental events adhere to scientific laws and follow the principles of psychic determinism. And the reason free association works is because each association, according to Freud, is connected to the next and to the preceding one. And as a result of his contribution, Freud has emerged as a major source of a modern Vokatanskian inclination to look for meaning beneath the surface of behavior. However, there were certain important aspects of the human psyche that Freud failed to notice that other Viennese modernists did. He had very little insight into female sexuality. Now, there's a large debate as to why this is so. The discussion is based upon the fact that it is unclear whether he had slept with one woman only in his life or he may have slept with a second woman. The second woman, as some of you know, was his sister-in-law. She lived with them, and at one time on holiday, the two of them went off by themselves and shared a same room. This meant nothing, but some people like to give him credit and say he had experience with a second woman. This is in contrast to Gustav Klimt, who slept with 300 different women. Now, Gustav Klimt really had an understanding of female sexuality. And those of you who are not aware of it, you don't see it so much in his paintings, although one of his paintings, which I'll come to, is fantastic. But you see it in his drawings. Are some of you familiar with Klimt's drawings? Well, of course, Everett, you know everything. There's no question. He only looks at Klimt's drawings. He never pays any attention to the paintings because the drawings show in the most delicate, non-pornographic form what female sexuality is about. He learned a lot from Rodin. Rodin told his models, look, don't model for me, don't pose. Just hang around my studio, do whatever you want, and if I'm interested, I'll sketch you. And Klimt said the same thing. So the girls got bored after a while. They began to masturbate. Some would sleep with other girls. Some would sleep with the men as they came through. And Klimt would draw this. And these absolutely wonderful pictures he was able to depict, which in no way pornographic, obscene, they delicately indicate women's richness of sexual experience. And to appreciate how radical this was, let me show you what the conventional historical view of the female nude is in Western art. So we're looking at Giorgione, Titian, Goya, Manet. These are not minor artists. These are major artists. There are several features. One is the female nude is always looking out at the beholder, usually a man, as if the only job in her life was to satisfy the sexual curiosity of the beholder, of the viewer, number one. Number two, these are mythological women. Venus, Maya, Olympia. This is not the girl next door. This is some magical woman. And finally, if you look very carefully, you'll see that a left hand, in three cases out of four, is covering a pubic area. Now, you don't know, is this modesty or is she masturbating? With Klimt, there's never a moment's hesitation. You know immediately what's going on. But I think the most powerful image that Klimt ever painted is Judith from Judith and Holofernes. You probably know the story of Judith Holofernes. Let me tell you a little bit about this. Holofernes led an Assyrian troop that formed a siege around a small town near Jerusalem called Bethlehem. After several weeks, the siege became unbearable for the people living there. There were no sanitary conditions. There was no food. People were in horrible condition. So Judith, a modest widow, 26 years old, thought she would take it upon herself to save her people. So she took a handmaiden, and they snuck out between the troops forming the siege. And she found Holofernes. He was at a party drinking. She encouraged him to drink a little bit more, which he did. Then she encouraged him to take her to his tent, which he did. There she encouraged him to make love to her, which he did. And after that, exhausted from sex and drink, he fell asleep. She took a sword off the wall and chopped off his head. Now, this is often depicted in Western art, this modest widow sacrificing herself for a people. This is not Klimt's depiction of Judith. She's half nude in a post-coital trance, still enjoying the fantasies of the sex she had, wearing a Wiener Werkstätte outfit, and fondling his head in the corner of the painting. Absolutely shocking, just amazing, simply to show that women confuse aggression with eroticism, just like men can. How did Rokatansky who influenced these artists, influenced Klimt? Well, it's very simple. She did it through Zuckerkandel, as all of you probably know. Bertha Zuckerkandel ran the great salon in Vienna. Have any of you been invited to Bertha Zuckerkandel's salon? You have not made it in Vienna until you invited her. She said, on my diva, Vienna comes alive. Everyone who is anybody came to our salon. Writers came, scientists came, businessmen, political leaders came. They all came there. You couldn't get elected to public office if you didn't come to her salon. She was the wife of Emil Zuckerkandel, and Emil Zuckerkandel was Rokatansky's right-hand person. The Zuckerkandel organ is named for him, an outstanding anatomist. Klimt became fascinated with Zuckerkandel. Emil became fascinated with biology. He bought 4 volumes of Darwin. He read Darwin. When he died, these 4 volumes were present in his library. How many of you have 4 volumes of Darwin in your library? Erwin, do you have 4 volumes? No. If Erwin doesn't have it, no one has it. So then he began to go to his lectures. He began to look into the microscope, and he became fascinated with the depiction of sperm and eggs, and began to incorporate these depictions into his paintings. And you'll never look at a Klimt painting again once you realize this. Look at this Klimt painting, Zeus coming to Diana in a shower of golden raindrops. So you see, this is, of course, Diana. This is the shower of raindrops. But if you look very carefully, you see this rectangular symbol. That rectangular symbol is sperm. Whenever you see that in a Klimt painting, you realize this is sperm. Here, you see a fertilized ovum. Whenever you see that, you realize you're dealing at a female's ovum. Let me just show you. This is the famous painting, The Kiss. You look at the man's garment. They're calling me again. Tell them I'll be finished in about 2 hours from now. You have these rectangular symbols on his coat. Oh, this is probably outside. And you have the circular symbols on her coat. The wonderful thing about Klimt was not only he was an extraordinary artist, but he was extremely supportive of 2 younger artists, of Kokoschka and of Schiele. They did not train with him directly. In fact, they broke with his tradition, but he was extremely supportive of their careers. Let me begin with Kokoschka, who's somewhat older. He got away from the decorative style which characterized Klimt, and he began to bring Viennese art into an expressionist era. And he was interested in 3 major themes. He was very much interested by psychoanalytic ideas, and he said, I never read Freud. I discovered it all by myself. He had a deep interest of going below the surface, and he realized that to understand other people, you have to understand yourself first. This is really sort of an analytic idea. Freud ended each day, half an hour, analyzing himself. And this is the same of Kokoschka's point of view. Moreover, he realized in his paintings, you don't just communicate emotion with your face, but also with your hands. And he had a fascination with child and adolescent sexuality. Let me give you some examples. This is typical Klimt. This is Bloch Bauer, now hanging in New York. You see the symbols. These are the male sexual symbols, female sexual symbols. But look at the background. This is typical Klimtish background. This is an Art Nouveau background. If you look at Kokoschka, it's completely unnatural, the background. Even the colors that he uses on his face are natural. He uses red. He wants to convey emotion rather than reality. And this is period when he was going with Alma Mahler. This is actually just after he broke with Alma Mahler. The whole time he was going with Alma Mahler, he was on the verge of a nervous breakdown because she was sure that Alma would leave him for Gropius or somebody else. And of course, with time, she did. So he was always sort of, if any of you have ever been to Basel and seen the Tempest by Kokoschka. She's sleeping peacefully there in his little boat at sea, and he's ready to jump over because he's so insecure in his relationship. And his depiction, not only is he very honest in depicting himself, but he uses his hands, including bringing to his mouth and the abnormal color fingernails, to depict these emotions even more powerfully. He felt that he was a Menschenkenner, that when he painted people, he studied them. He studied how they function. And he argued that I really get to know people so well from studying this way, I can predict their future. He became very friendly with Adolf Loos. And Adolf Loos would approach people like Erwin saying, you know, you are an outstanding person. You are both a parliamentarian and a physician. You deserve to have Kokoschka paint your painting. If you don't like it, return it and I'll take it back. Well, a number of people accepted it. For example, Auguste Forel, great psychiatrist, professor at the University of Zurich, who was director of Birkholzi for a while, his family and he agreed that Kokoschka would paint his painting. He showed up for 2 weeks in the evening after dinner, he painted it, and when it was done, family looked at it, Forel looked at it and said, we don't like it. Look, the two eyes are asymmetrical. And look at the hand. His right hand is hanging down as if he had a stroke. They gave the painting back. Loos sold the painting to museum. 2 months later, Forel had this identical stroke. Now, it's not unusual for people who ultimately have a stroke to have an ischemic episode earlier in which some of the symptoms of the stroke are evident. And perhaps this happened here. But in several cases, including a psychotic episode that occurred to somebody several months later, he predicted this while painting. He painted adolescent subjects. First painter who ever painted an adolescent female nude. This is Lee from the Träumende Knabe. He depicts her in nude, a very delicate depiction of her. And he also depicted young children. This is the children of the Stein family, Lotte and Walter. They're playing on the ground, and you can see both the aggression and the eroticism. He wants to pull her close, and she gets ready to punch him if he gets too close. Gombrich, the art historian, who thought that Kokoschka was the greatest portrait painter of his time, loved this painting. And he said about this, in the past, a child in a painting had to look pretty and contented. Grown-ups did not want to know about the sorrows and agonies of childhood. They resented it if this aspect of it was brought home to them. But Kokoschka would not fall in with these demands of convention. We feel he looked at these children with deep sympathy and compassion. He has caught their wistfulness and dreaminess, the awkwardness of their movements and the disharmonies of their growing body. His work is all the more true to life for what it lacks in conventional accuracy. So let me finish the three artists by telling you a little bit about Egon Schiele, who in some ways is the most radical of the three. Schiele didn't simply use face and hands. He felt he had to use his whole body to explore the existential anxiety of modern life. Remember, it's a painting around 1910 until 1918. And he did most of his paintings with himself in a nude. Now, Klimt never did a self-portrait. Kokoschka, as I told you, did several. But Schiele, in a one-year period, which I'll show you in a moment, did 100 self-portraits. 100. This is more than Rembrandt or Beckmann, who did self-portraits throughout their life. In 1 year, he did this amazing thing. But what is so characteristic of him is this, the angst, the inner angst. Even when he's making love, he looks like he's about to die. So this is him with his lover at that time. And he did a lot of the paintings, particularly in this one period, 1910 to 1911, when he did 100 self-portraits. A lot of these were done nude. He would position himself in odd cases. And the most amazing himself, some of these were so provocative, they were insulting. He painted himself masturbating. Klimt had shown women masturbating, so why not show men masturbating? And if so, why not himself? I mean, just amazing what he tried to do. Let me go to the second phase, and that is art historians' response to this, the beholder's share, the psychology of art. Before we could have a brain science, in every area, we have to have an underlying cognitive psychology. And this began with Alois Riegel, a Viennese. He was at the Vienna School of Art History, an outstanding art historian, not fully appreciated in the United States, but really a pioneer. He said, art history is going to die unless it becomes more scientific. The science it ought to relate itself to is psychology, and the problem it ought to focus on is the beholder's share, how the viewer responds to a work of art. This is the most obvious question in the world. No art historian had ever raised that. He said, you want to understand on an experimental basis how people respond when they look at a work of art. This challenge was taken up by two of his late disciples, Ernst Chris and Ernst Gombrich, both of whom trained here. Ernst Chris realized one thing. He said, when you and I look at the same painting, we see it somewhat differently. What does that mean? That means each of us is undergoing a creative process in our own right. We see the same object in somewhat different ways because we reconstruct it in different ways. So that means to a very modest degree, the beholder is undergoing a creative experience which parallels in a modest way the creative experience of the artist. This is a revolutionary insight. Gombrich got extremely excited about this and picked this up. He wanted to understand perception, how the beholder perceives a work of art. And he began to read about this, and he realized, look, when I look at Irwin, I don't see Irwin. All I see is the photons bouncing off his face. That's all my retina sees. And this is completely inadequate for me to reconstruct Irwin without further source of information. And yet I see Irwin. I see him often. He always looks the same, doesn't age, and all of you see him pretty much the same way I see him. How do we explain that when we have inadequate information? Obviously, we must be getting additional information. And Helmholtz pointed out there are two additional sources of information. One is bottom-up information. The human brain was not born yesterday. There have been millions of years of evolution. So the human brain has evolved in a certain world. And it knows pretty much, under most circumstances, what to expect. It knows that it sees a source of light above. I'm sorry, if it sees a source of light, it's likely to be above because the sun is above. If it sees a person much larger than another person, the larger person is likely to be closer to you than the other person is farther away. Bottom-up gives us the information that is built into the brain. We don't need any other information, and a lot of vision is provided for us. But we also live in different environments. We hang around with different people. We see different arts. We learn. Throughout all our life, we learn, and that top-down influence also determines how we respond to work of art. We may like certain things more, certain things less, because of tastes we've developed over time. So Gombrich was fascinated by this, and he realized if, in fact, bottom-up is built upon average expectations, you should be able to trick bottom-up processing. And he began to study this, illusions. The very famous illusion is called the Casaniga Square, in which you see a black square lying on top of white circles. Do you see this black square lying on top of four white circles? Do you all see that? I want to make sure that everybody in the audience sees it. Please raise your hand if you see it. You're making it up. It's all in your head. It's not there. What you have is four open circles, and you fill this in. There is no square at all. This is a visual illusion that you create because bottom-up processes has taught you to believe that if this situation exists, it's filled in. So Chris and Gombrich developed sort of the three-step analysis of the beholder share, perception, emotional empathy, and again indicated that the mental representation of the beholder share, and someday we'll understand the brain mechanisms for it. He actually, at the end of his life, he died in 2006, began to explore the biological basis, which is the final thing I want to discuss with you. What are the brain mechanisms underlying the beholder share? This is just what we're beginning to study now. And I'm going to focus on the face, another person's face. We analyze the facial contour, special region of the brain, special region involved in facial detail, representation of the body in addition to the face, an analysis of the body when it's stationary, when it's in motion, when it's in action, doing, carrying out specific things. There are parts of the brain that are involved with mental acts on the part of the beholder, on the part of the person that is being looked at, and also empathy, responding to their emotional state. So I will just discuss a few of these. Let me begin with analysis of facial, because I'm speaking so much about portraiture. We know a great deal about the representation of faces. Darwin first pointed out, as I said before, that faces are essential For social interaction, we recognize each other and even ourselves when we look into the mirror and see the face. And we communicate through faces, not only in terms of affection, but also anger, and even in business deals. You have to be comfortable with the person that you're interacting with. In political interactions, you want to be comfortable with the person that you vote for. And you see the integrity, the honesty depicted on their face. So faces are very similar and are very important. And as you will see, there's more area in the brain depicted to faces than any other object. Faces are difficult for computers to recognize, but we can recognize, particularly young people, hundreds of faces. You can put a young kid in a monkey colony, it'll learn to recognize over 100 different monkeys by face alone. We have difficulty recognizing 2 or 3 monkeys from each other at our age. Moreover, if you draw a drawing, if you make a cartoon of somebody, you accentuate their characteristic features. You, madame, I would draw a scarf. This is how one recognizes you in the audience, and makes it easier to recognize somebody. So a cartoon of Rembrandt is easier to recognize than Rembrandt himself. And there's some very unusual thing. If I take this glass of water and turn it upside down, you would recognize it as a glass, and of course you'd see the water spilled. But if you take a face and turn it upside down, you have a difficult time recognizing it. So those of you who are sophisticated may realize this is Mona Lisa, Leonardo's painting hanging in the Louvre. But you won't realize that these are completely different expressions. This is the enigmatic Mona Lisa, and this is a completely distorted Mona Lisa, because upside down, you can recognize that. What about the representation of faces in the brain? In 1947, relatively recently, Joachim Bodner, a German neurologist, first recognized the syndrome we now call prosopagnosia. He dealt with 2 people wounded in action who had lost the ability to recognize faces, which is called prosopagnosia, a difficulty recognizing faces. And he realized it's a particular region of the brain that is damaged. Now, you know they have 4 lobes, frontal, parietal, occipital, temporal. Visual information comes in the back through the occipital lobe and then spills forward into the temporal lobe. And Bodner made us realize that this is where faces are represented. If you have a lesion here in the posterior inferior temporal cortex, you don't even recognize a face qua face. If you have a lesion here, you recognize a face qua face, but you don't recognize who it is. This is not rare. 10% of people are born with this problem. We now have some understanding of what that representation represents. In the last several years, people have combined 2 great methodologies, imaging and single-cell recording. It began with Charles Gross. He began to do single-cell recording, and he realized that in this region, there are some cells that respond to faces. More recently, in the last 3 years, Doris Chow, Marge Livingston, and Winfried Freiwald combined imaging and single-cell recording. They showed monkeys, pictures of monkeys, and they saw what happened. And they saw there were 6 face patches that lit up. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Moreover, they realized this was a system for face processing, because when they put electrodes down and stimulated the central area, they lit up the other areas. So these are interconnected patterns of face areas. What happens if you look at these face areas? Here's one of these face patches in a monkey. You show a monkey, a picture of a monkey, it likes looking at another monkey. Brrr, cell fires. If you showed a cartoon of a monkey, fires even more. Brrr. For some reason, the cartoon does not require a nose. Probably, we think, because noses don't participate in emotion very much. But everything else has to be there, complete gestalt. So you have to have the circle, you have to have the eyes, you have to have the mouth. If you remove the mouth, gone is the response. Move the eyes, gone is the response. Eyes and mouth, no response. If you don't have the circle, circle alone, no response. You've got to have the whole schmear in order to get brrr. If you exaggerate it, the cells respond even more. If you turn it upside down, what happens if you turn it upside down? No response, right? They don't see, cells don't see faces upside down. This may be a hint to me. Okay. I'm finishing up. Let me just, without taking you through detail, show you what happens in these other brain areas. So information comes in at the back of the head through the what is called the striate cortex. It's passed on for further processing to the inferior temporal cortex where faces are represented. Then there is an area called the lateral occipital complex where vision and tactile sensation are represented. And you notice with many painters, you see this with Soutine, you see this with de Kooning, painters who slap on the paint, very thick, Jackson Pollock, you have a tactile feel as well as a visual sensitization. Bernard Berenson would say he really feels certain paintings with his fingertips. This is because this area becomes active. There are areas that are involved with seeing bodies. There are areas that are involved in motion, including motion of a car or a bicycle. And there are areas that are involved in biological motion. Now, if you have an autistic child, for example, do you think the area with biological motion is going to be absolutely normal? If I reach out my hand, do you think that child is able to respond? No. One of the things you can tell diagnostically is this area does not become active when you move toward a child with autism. In contrast, it does to a child that does not have autism. There are two areas that are involved in mirror responses. So a monkey will respond in these areas if the monkey picks up a glass of water. That's not surprising. The motor area is paid to pick up the glass of water. But it also responds when I pick up a glass of water if the monkey sees me. So the monkey, these areas are imitating. And we now realize these areas are also present in humans, and probably infant children acquire language not only by listening to their parents, particularly the mothers, but also seeing the facial expression and the movements of the mouth. In addition, there's an area involved with empathy, theory of mind. Mature people, and this is again something autistic people have difficulty, realizing that you, madame, have different ideas, different expectations in your head than I have. We each have our own psychological driving force. But what about emotion? Well, they're also represented very powerfully in the brain. There is an area in the brain called the amygdala, which orchestrates all emotion, positive as well as negative and mixtures thereof. There's an area in the hypothalamus that executes those emotions. And there's a modulatory system in the brain called dopamine that is a modulator of emotion. Let me give you an example. We now have a beginning understanding of Judith and Holofernes. And we understand why commonly in life, eroticism and aggression can be fused in a variety of ways. Why is that so? David Anderson began to record in the hypothalamus, and he found there are two populations of neurons, one involved with eroticism, including mating, and the other involved in aggression. And they're contiguous with one another. And 20% of the cells are shared. Eroticism and aggression have a shared population of cells, a mixed population. And whether you activate one or the other depends upon intensity of stimulation. Anderson was able to put a special ion channel into these cells, a channel that can be activated by light. It's called channel rhodopsin. And he found that if you activate it weakly, you get mating behavior, erotic behavior. If you stimulate it strongly, fighting. So with weak stimulation, you have foreplay. With strong stimulation, God knows what happens. So this brings together Freud, Klimt, Schiller, and the new science of mind. Let me end by one thing. Can brain science reveal something about the love of art? Ronald Lauder paid $135 million for Adele Bloch-Bauer. How could somebody want to pay this amount of money for that painting? Well, I'll tell you exactly why he paid that much. And when he bought it, he thought it was a bargain. He was willing to pay more. He first saw this when he came to Vienna his first time. He was 8 years old. Oper Belvedere. He fell in love with it. He thought this was ideal womanhood. Everything went to the modern Mona Lisa. And he comes from a very wealthy family. Not a chance in the world that a museum would let him buy this. So it activated the orbital frontal cortex, which is concerned with seeking of pleasure, and modulatory systems of the brain, particularly the dopaminergic system. Now, the dopaminergic system involves many aspects of the beholder share, and it is recruited for a number of things. Primary rewards, such as food, drink, and sex, addiction, romantic love, and love of art. Now, the amazing thing about this, for example, and romantic love, and some of you may have experienced it, I've experienced it once or twice, obviously the dopamine system gets pumped up when you fall in love, but if you're ever rejected by your love object, the dopamine system goes wild. And the same with art. You fall in love with a work of art. If you can't have it, if you're deprived of it, if you're rejected, the dopamine system goes wild. So Lauder, year after year, comes and sees this. He becomes the American ambassador to Austria, lives in Vienna, tortures himself repeatedly coming to look at it. His dopamine system is going wild. Offering, he would have paid $140 million for this painting. So he was glad to get it for $135 million. So let me end. The great enterprise of the human mind, E. O. Wilson said, has been, always will be, the attempt to form linkages between the sciences and the humanities. Viennese modernists were the first to establish these linkages in art and science by focusing on the beholder share. And these pioneering attempts in this great enterprise continue at the Medical University of Vienna, where the spirit of modernism is carried forward to this day. Thank you very much.